Hello, it's Tuesday the 22nd of June, though the weather feels more like October. I'm Jim White, sitting in for Andrew Pearce, who's taking a well-earned staycation. And this is The Andrew Pearce Show, coming direct from the Daily Mail newsroom. On the show today, the oldest millennial is now turning 40. So what's the future hold for them now over the next decades, particularly financially? Plus, Love Island is back. Most sane people will be giving it a swerve. But are we all missing out on something culturally significant? We'll be finding out. And apparently, there are a couple of big football matches tonight. But has the Euros' new qualification process diminished all the tension we normally experience in international competitions? I'll be discussing permutations with a man who knows. But first, the government is apparently again considering COVID passports to allow vaccinated people to enter pubs and restaurants without restriction. Previous plans were shelved when ministers switched focus away from hospitality venues towards travel and large events. But now it's back on the agenda, and apparently the passport would reportedly be used via a new function on the NHS app, which would allow people in England to demonstrate their vaccination status. Dozens of Tory MPs are said to have warned that they'll vote against this use of COVID passports in pubs. But ministers are said to believe opposition may soften if the alternative is to close parts of the economy in the event of another COVID wave this autumn. Well, with me to discuss this possibility is Ray Walsh, digital privacy expert at Pro Privacy. Ray, why is this back on the agenda? I thought the government threw it out as unworkable a couple of months ago.
Sure. Well, there's a few different considerations that I want to get through for your listeners on this topic. And I think the first is that we know that the government has wanted to introduce a national ID, has been talking about implementing a national ID card since as long back as the 80s and the early 90s, when they were first started as a way to improve security in the country. And the government has attempted to bring ID cards to the UK in the past, specifically with the Identity Cards Act of 2006, which was repealed in 2011 after causing, you know, a huge amount of backlash from human rights lawyers, privacy advocates, activists, and also the general public. So we know that the political will is there, because there is no doubt that a nationwide ID system creates a heightened potential for tracking citizens and placing them under surveillance as they move around the country. And it seems very concerning that the pandemic is now sort of being latched onto as a way to bring this kind of surveillance in surreptitiously under the guise of being a necessity to neutralize the threat of the pandemic and to bring lockdown to an end in such a way that people can get back to normality, you know, travel both in the country and abroad without the threat of quarantine. And like you say, now the government has now put the possibility of a vaccination passport system for entering restaurants and pubs back on the table, which means that we are potentially looking at a situation which the general public won't be able to do normal things that they, you know, are usually able to do unless they agree to use the vaccination ID system. And these ongoing concerns about the introduction of a passport, a vaccination passport, and the privacy and human rights concerns they create, which I think are severe, are the main concern for the general public.
So you generally see this not as a kind of public health initiative, but as part of a wider agenda to keep track on the populace, do you?
Exactly. I mean, privacy advocates have been complaining about the vaccination passport, you know, since it was first touted and talked about a few months ago. Now, you know, those concerns are being galvanised by the fact that the government has chosen to award the contract for the vaccination certification system to a company called Entrust, which is a private company that is on the record with comments that explicitly encourage governments to introduce vaccination passport systems because they can be leveraged to acquire additional data from citizens, and because they can eventually be repurposed into full-fledged ID card systems. And with that in mind, it's hard not to raise the alarm, because this is the very company the government is choosing to work with. And when that company has a vested interest in creating a system that's used not only during the pandemic, but also once the threat of the virus has been neutralized, then you can see why, you know, it gets worrying.
Yeah, but the thing is, Ray, if it's done via the existing NHS app, I mean, most of us have gone into the pub and kind of flashed our phone vaguely at the barcode as we're instructed to do when we enter. It's not really tracking us down, is it? I mean, most of us don't even bother, do we?
Well, that's the thing. I think if they're going to make it compulsory to prove that you've had the vaccine, then it becomes a different level, doesn't it? It means that you won't be able to just sort of put your phone number down at the door if you want to and not bring your phone. So it's going to take it up to the next level. It's going to require you to have the app at all times. It's going to have to, you're going to have to prove that you really did take those vaccines. And not everybody has necessarily had both vaccines. So there's also an issue of liberty involved in addition to privacy. And a White Horse source has admitted that the trials it's planning to enter into this summer are designed not only to get mass events open more safely and with bigger crowds, but also to get people used to the idea of a vaccination passport system. And I think that comment really sums up our concern over pro-privacy, because it seems that there is an element of mission creep involved. And there's no doubt that this is exactly the kind of identity tracking system that the government has wanted to implement for many years, and that the general public and experts were united against before the pandemic. And while we can all agree that dealing with a pandemic and getting the country open is important, we also need the government to be absolutely transparent over the use of people's data, over how that data will be processed and leveraged, over what third-party purposes it might also be leveraged for, other than ensuring people are safe from the virus, whether that can be used for additional things such as police work and surveillance, for example, because that's not what the explicit purpose of a vaccination passport system should be. And we want to ensure the government is promising not to leverage or repurpose the data or the system either now or at any point in the future, and we would like the government to provide clear sunset clauses so that when the pandemic is over and the virus is under control, people can go back to living in the same kind of circumstances that they were used to prior to the pandemic.
Do you get the sense, you said there, that the idea of a card that we all have, an identification card, is something that the public is naturally inclined against? Do you get the feeling that the pandemic has changed that? Do you think the government has sensed rightly that we might be thinking of the health issues here so they can slip it through? I mean, is there a sense that the mood is changing in the country towards it?
Exactly. I think that because people are afraid, fear is always a very good mechanism to use to force things that you already wanted for these different reasons. And so the people have a right to want to use new systems for public health, and they have a right to expect the government to roll out those systems in such a way that they are used for those purposes and those purposes only. But when we know that the exact same system was desirable prior to the pandemic and prior to these necessities, then we have to be aware that the government may latch onto them and use them even once the pandemic is over. And we don't want to be left in a country where freedoms are under threat and where privacy is under threat simply because of the pandemic. And so we need both. We need the government to provide the means to be safe, but also to promise to take these things away once they aren't needed anymore.
Many thanks there, Ray Walsh, who's a digital privacy expert at Pro Privacy. Some very, very interesting thoughts there. Thank you, Ray. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. For those looking for help in starting a family, the news is not wholly good. Egg donors, much like sperm donors, were already in short supply before the pandemic, and COVID has only exacerbated waiting times after donation services were paused. Lockdown has also meant that young women who previously would have donated their eggs were distracted by COVID-related worries or felt nervous about going to clinics, according to experts. Demand has remained high, however, with almost one in five women over 40 who have IVF treatment choosing to use another woman's eggs, for the simple reason that using eggs from a younger person increases chances of successful conception. Supply, however, is not keeping up. With me to discuss this is Jane Holman of donation agency Altruary. Now, Jane, there's long been a gap between supply and demand when it comes to good quality eggs. In what ways have lockdowns exacerbated that problem?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, certainly recipients who have normally been through a lengthy and painful fertility journey to get to this point of considering using donor eggs, usually these patients want to move on relatively quickly. And unfortunately, I think we've always struggled with getting good quality egg donors in the UK. And I think this has sort of promoted sort of tourism really in relation to egg donation and patients seeking treatment overseas in the past. But I think certainly over the pandemic that hasn't been an option for a lot of patients. So certainly at Altruvi, we've noticed that there's been a greater demand for donors that are based in the UK. And we've had to obviously look to try and support those patients as best we possibly can, because it is a really tough old road for these patients to have to go down. So I think certainly from our side of things, we've wanted to try and maintain the number of donors that we try to source at Altruvi, and we've done that in a number of ways, obviously by sort of increasing our marketing to try and get the word out there and increase the knowledge base about the need for egg donation in the UK. And I think also for donors as well, we've tried to support them with different pathways to reassure them that we can still go ahead with treatment, even though there has been lockdown and we've sort of struggled to maintain the cycles at some clinics. So we've introduced sort of virtual pathways with some of our clinics, which means that donors aren't needing to go to the clinic for so many appointments. It's much more patient friendly. We can still support patients, donors going through this treatment process. And we've maintained the numbers as a result. So, you know, it's been really helpful for a lot of patients that we've been working with to try to maintain the throughput of treatment cycles, definitely.
You called it a tough old road. What are the physical and mental implications of being obliged to wait even longer for this treatment because of the pandemic?
Yeah, I think it really does. It takes its toll. These, as I mentioned, these patients, usually the recipients that are coming to us, have been through numerous treatment cycles. The emotional roller coaster and the pain of trying to conceive using their own eggs. And I think we sort of underestimate that a little bit. And I think obviously patients do need support. That can be offered in the form of counselling and just, I suppose, continuity of care and I suppose feeling looked after. So I think it has huge implications for recipients, and yeah, we can't overlook that for these patients going through treatment. So I think if we can try and support them as quickly and in the best possible way that we can, that's obviously got to be an added bonus for them, most definitely.
You talked about new pathways to get donors towards treatment. How do you get new donors to come forward? People who maybe not thought about it before. How can you encourage them in these circumstances?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, it's about raising awareness. You know, it's about getting the word out there. And I think certainly with Altruvi, we do a lot in the way of supporting donors through the process, informing them. You know, we've got some social media groups to raise awareness, and really where some of our donors help to engage with new potential donors and provide them with information sort of from the horse's mouth, because it's all well and good them coming to us and us telling them what's involved. But I think, you know, that hearing it again from someone that's been through that process is very, very reassuring. And I think, again, for us, we work very closely with our marketing teams to sort of get the word out there, doing things like webinars and, you know, just trying to sort of engage with more and more donors. And I think because we very much take pride in looking after the donors as they go through the process, a lot of the donors do return to us to go through it again. And you know, a lot of it is word of mouth as well. So we will get donors coming forward as a result of maybe a friend's experience, and they want to look into it too. So, yeah, I think trying to source good quality egg donors is difficult in the UK. It's incredibly difficult. And we sort of persist in trying to keep the numbers going constantly, because we can never have enough, really, if I'm honest.
Very good point. But I wonder, how long do you think it's going to take after this delay to get things back to even where they were, never mind where you want them to be?
Yeah, I think it will. It's a difficult one, because I think donors, and recipients, all patients want reassurance that it is safe to go ahead, safe to proceed with treatment. You know, COVID's had a huge impact that nobody would have ever thought of, and lasted for much longer than we could have thought in the outset. But I think certainly for donors, I think in particular, we've changed the way that we work with some of our clinics, in that we offer these virtual pathways, which means that we can look at donors having scans locally to where they live. They can have blood draws potentially at the scanning clinic, or they could have a phlebotomist going to the patient's home to take the blood. So it's more about the offering flexibility and it being a little bit more user-friendly, so we can accommodate requests and we're not asking donors to get on trains and travel for significant distances and take a huge amount of time out of their potentially their working day to attend the clinic. So for us, I think, you know, working with the clinics, we've got a slightly different approach. I think that has allowed us to engage with a good number of donors. So our throughput of donors has been steady. It has also been increasing as well. So it's been consistently good, which, is really reassuring. So I hope that things will only improve from this point onwards once lockdown sort of eases and we start to resume a little bit of normality.
Oh, good. A hint of optimism there. Many thanks to Jane Holman of the Egg Donation Agency, Altruy. Thanks, Jane. If you want to get in touch, you can tweet us at MailPlus or get direct to Andrew at Tory Boy Pierce. Well, here's some news that will make some of us at least feel ancient. The oldest millennials this year turn 40. And a recent book by Anne Helen Peterson on what awaits in the future describes them as the burnout generation. We're trying to build solid foundations out of quicksand, she writes. And it seems millennial and Generation Z workers are increasingly changing jobs much more frequently than previous generations. These days, 91% of millennials expect to stay in their current job for no more than 2 years. So how on earth do you plan for the future in such circumstances, particularly financially? Joining me now is Edgar Di Picciotto, co-founder of Ikigai, which is a wealth-building app for millennials. Edgar, do you agree with that? I mean, do you think that there is such a thing as millennial burnout?
I mean, there's definitely a trend. And I think that the trend that millennials are changing jobs very fast. I think that there's also the pandemic that accentuated it. So there is definitely more and more stories of burnout. I mean, the thing is, even before the pandemic, the millennials are used to a workplace culture that is kind of an always-on culture, you know, because you always have your phone on, you never turn it off, so you're always there replying to your work email, even during your dinner. And because of that, millennials have... They're very involved in their job, and that creates a huge demand on them, and also a huge emotional involvement in their job. The thing is, with the pandemic, everything went even more intense. The intensity increased because when you work from home and you have your work on your phone, when do you stop? Do you put an alarm at 5 p.m. and just stop working? That could work, but actually none of your other coworkers do like that. And that creates even more pressure for the millennials. And that creates a whole new range of issues in terms of mental health and so leads to more burnout.
And how does that affect their attitude to money? Why is that different from previous generations? I understand that working systems are different, but why is the attitude to money different?
Yeah, so actually what is very interesting is millennials is a generation that is actually better at budgeting and savings. They have learned to be more responsible with their money. In fact, 61% of millennials budget and save more responsibly. And that's more than any previous generation. And 3 in 5 have a very clear saving strategy. And that's because they are seeing the cost of the goods rising, the salary is increasing, but not that much. And so they need to be prepared. I think a typical example of that is the access to property. There's much less millennials who are going to access property because, I mean, first, of course, they want more flexibility in where they want to live, but also they just don't have the same capital that the capital required for access to property.
And is the traditional market for savings, for banking and so on, keeping up with the changes that millennials are facing?
So, I mean, partly yes and partly no. So the traditional banking, I think it is very difficult for them to keep up. So they're still in a logic of, you know, a large big bank, they will make the money on the big lifetime events like the mortgages. But with, as I just said, a decreasing access to property, mortgages are not as important as they used to be to an individual's life. And that changes a lot the relationship. And that makes it very difficult for traditional banks to be attractive and interesting to millennials. Similarly, I mean, the millennials are in this always-on culture with their phone. The traditional banks, they haven't yet managed to catch up on that. It's still a pain to know exactly what your balance is, to check your transactions in traditional banks apps, and that's why you have all of these new digital banks, neo banks coming like Mongo, Starling, Revolut, and Ikigai, that are here and coming and telling to the millennials, hey, this is the banking solution for your needs. You'll be able to check your spending in real time. You'll be able to budget better, and you'll actually be able to invest, which is something that millennials are more and more interested in.
The bottom line here, Edgar, so millennials are much better at budgeting, as you've said. They're on their phones, so they're checking their bank balances a lot more, but they haven't got those traditional forms of wealth investment like property. Are they going to end up as rich as the previous generations, do you think?
That's a tough question, and no one really knows. What is clear is that because they won't all buy a house, they will have more cash on their hands. At the same time, there's going to be a massive wealth transfer from the boomer generation to the millennials. And they're also delaying getting married and having kids. So all of that makes me think that they're going to have more cash on their hands. Now, the big question is, what are they going to do with the cash? There is one trend that is millennials are less and less about mindless wealth accumulation and more about spending for things that matter to them, like traveling when they can and seeing their friends at the restaurant, etc. The question is, are they going to take that wealth and start investing it? So what we've seen in the past year, where the millennials had more time on their hands and also more money because of decreased spending because of the pandemic, we saw definitely a trading boom, both in the cryptocurrency space and also in the general stock trading space. So the question is, are they going to make the smart investment decisions, which are the decisions that will bring them to a higher wealth level than previous generations?
Ah, it's all in the cryptocurrency, you reckon?
Exactly. I mean, the thing with the crypto, no one knows how it will pan out. And I mean, what we promote at Ikigai is always to think of your investments in a diversified manner. So crypto can definitely be a part of your investment portfolio, but it's important to, you know, not keep all of your eggs in the same basket, as they say.
Brilliant advice there from Edgar Di Picciotto, co-founder of Ikigai, the wealth building app for millennials. Thanks so much for joining us, Edgar. Well, you may have noticed there's a couple of football matches on tonight. England play the Czech Republic at Wembley, while Scotland face Croatia at Hampden Park. These are the last games for the home nations in the group stage. Joining me to talk us through what might happen next is Ian Ladyman, football editor of the Daily Mail and the man who knows. Now, listen, Ian. England have already qualified because of results elsewhere. So does tonight's game really matter?
Well, it does. It does in terms of what happens next for England. It seems a bit perverse that they've played two games, scored one goal, had three shots on target in total, but have already qualified. But that's the UEFA system for you. But it does matter, because if they win tonight, they'll finish top of the group, and that means that the amount of travelling that they need to do will be massively cut down. If they win tonight, they'll get a week off and then play their next game at home at Wembley a week tonight. And then if they win that one, they might go abroad for one game. However, if they were to finish second, if they weren't to win tonight, they finish second in the group, then they'll go to Copenhagen at the weekend. And then if they were to win that game next Monday, they would then go on to St. Petersburg. So it's hardly the most arduous travelling in the world. But equally, I'm sure that given the choice, Gareth Southgate and the players would rather be tucked up in their familiar beds at St. George's Park for the next week, ready for another game at Wembley. So from that point of view, it does matter what happens tonight.
And what about Scotland? What do they need to do to get through?
Scotland could do with a win. And the thing with Scotland is that they've had two, a very good performance against England in drawing 0-0 on Friday, having lost the first game 2-0 to the Czech Republic. They actually played okay in that first game, and they played very well against England, but what they haven't done so far is score a goal. So that really needs to change tonight. And if they can get a win this evening, then they will also head through into the next stage, which would be a hell of an achievement for a nation that are ranked 44th in the world.
Now, listen, the extended format with teams able to qualify for third place in their group, it's taken away a lot of the jeopardy of these final round of matches, hasn't it? It's been a rubbish idea, basically, hasn't it?
Yeah, and they had the same idea was in play 5 years ago when we had the last European Championships in France. They had exactly the same thing happened. It does take away a lot of the jeopardy. That is the word. I don't think that having, being in England's shoes, for example, having scored one goal in two games, I don't think that should be enough to get you through into the next stage. But it is, and we know the reasons why. The very simple reason is UEFA want this tournament to be as big as possible, to last as long as possible, to have as many games as possible, because that means that they get more revenue from tickets, from TV deals, from sponsorship. So in order to do that, they've had to cram in an extra round. The European Championships used to go group stage straight to quarter final. Now we have an extra round crammed in, the round of 16. And in order to get 24 teams into 16, that obviously means that four of the third place teams have to qualify, if that makes sense.
There was a lot of talk before the tournament that England might be one of the favourites. Are you still confident as the knockouts approach?
I said beforehand that if they got to the last four, they'd have done very well. They were favourite. I mean, England, the bookies aren't never very bold, are they? The bookies back themselves, all sides. And England are always pretty short prices for these tournaments, despite the fact they haven't won one for 50 years. So it was a bit generous to have them as one of the favourites. I think, like I say, I still think semi-final would represent a successful tournament. They will have to improve. They will clearly have to improve on what we've seen so far. But then it can be done. Teams have won these tournaments after starting slowly. It can happen. The most important thing with the groups is to get through. England haven't lost a game yet. They haven't conceded a goal yet. So there are ticks in the ticks in the plus column. But the big tick in the negative column is that they haven't really played like a team capable of beating a really good opposition. But that's not to say that they can't improve.
Well, many thanks to Ian Ladyman, the Daily Mail's football editor, and his report on England against the Czech Republic will be in the paper tomorrow. It'll be the one to read. Thanks, Ian. The toned muscles, the bikini bodies, the fake tans, and the endless displays of needy narcissism can mean only one thing. Love Island is back. After an 18-month break due to the pandemic, the 11 singletons looking for love in the Majorcan villa were announced yesterday for a new series that starts at the end of the month. Now, frankly, some of us would rather stick our head in a bucket of custard than watch a moment of the new series, but are we missing out? Is Love Island a hideous metaphor for the vacuity of the modern world, or is it actually a cultural phenomenon well worth investing in? With me to discuss these issues is Eleanor Sharples, TV and radio reporter for the Daily Mail. Eleanor, first question, are you a fan?
Oh, Jim, I am. I really am. Yeah, I know it's, you know, it's not the best thing on TV. It is, as people would say, like trashy, but I just love it. It's an escape, and sometimes it's just something you need to watch.
It's been a huge worldwide hit, isn't it? It's not just us Britons who are obsessed by this. I've seen it in France. I mean, apparently it's in Australia. Well, why is it? Why are so many tuning in?
It's an absolutely great question. I just kind of think it's one of those things for people that it really is a bit of an escape. So when you do watch it, people, I mean, they love the fallouts that happen because one girl picks a guy that another girl likes. And I think people, in a weird type of way, it's maybe a bit relatable. They're all at quite similar age to me, so like, I quite enjoy it for that reason. But yeah, I just think it's a bit of an escape. And, you know, people can really kind of delve into other people's lives, which a lot of people like to do. So yeah, it is good, but it's an absolute phenomenon across the world, particularly Australia. They've had, I think, two series now, and it's also been on iPlayer, ITV Hub quite recently, so people have been able to watch that while we haven't been able to watch it for the last 18 months here, because obviously we haven't had it due to the pandemic. So yeah, it's a big deal, I think.
There have been all sorts of problems with online bullying and mental health issues in previous series. So how have the producers responded to that? Is this going to be different?
So a few years ago when they, unfortunately, the two deaths of two of their former contestants happened, they, ITV made quite rigorous changes to their, you know, duty of care following the show, and I guess also before it as well. And you know, when they come out of the villa, they really are thrown. I mean, they've been in the public eye for the 6 to 8 weeks that they've been in there, and then they really are thrown out there in terms of, you know, their social media followings absolutely gone sky high, and they're recognized in the street. You know, they get Instagram deals, they get deals with companies like clothing companies and things. So, you know, they really do become celebrities when they come out. So, you know, ITV have had to put in some serious like duty of care policy. So, for example, I believe this year it is minimum of 8 therapy sessions that they will receive once they come out. And, you know, they learn how to deal with and how to respond to, you know, criticism and, you know, potentially bullying on social media and comments and kind of how to deal with it, really. So yeah, it's a big deal for them. But at the same time, I do kind of think, you know what you're signing up to when you go in here. It's been proven for the last 6 series that they really do come out like celebrities and get offered these lucrative deals and people know who they are. So yeah, they do learn how to deal with it. But at the same time, I do think they know what they're signing up for.
I know it's not for everybody, Eleanor, but I've not watched a single moment of this series, and I know it's huge. Am I missing out?
Oh, gosh. I mean, missing out in terms of, I find it's a great conversation starter with the people that I do watch it and stuff. But it's a funny one. It is whether, if you like this kind of television, then you'll like it. But at the same time, if you're not and you feel like you haven't missed out so far, then why start on series 7? I actually think the first few series have actually been the best. So yeah, it's a funny one. If it's your cup of tea, which it is a bit of mine because I find it a bit of an escape and I like watching it, then it's great. But if it really isn't and you'd rather be, you know, into the latest drama or catching up on other things, then I don't think you're probably missing out, no.
Brilliant. Many thanks, Eleanor. That was Eleanor Sharples, TV and radio reporter for the Daily Mail. That's all we have time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. All this week at 5 p.m, you can hear me, Jim White, sitting in for Andrew Pearce on The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, try not to get too stressed by the football. Goodbye.